I'm Julia Boorstin, and you're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Good Tuesday morning. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Ford and Julia Boorstin. Today, the markets do bounce back. Got another move higher for the chips. Micron tops estimates. Got an upgrade for KLA. NVIDIA also named a top pick. There's a ton going on in semis. Plus, that exclusive sound from Bob Iger with Faber, his exit interview as he prepares to leave Disney. We'll talk about that. And then, what growth slowdown? Software company Braze, a recent IPO, reporting results for the first time. The stock shooting higher, and the CEO will join us this hour, John.
Yeah, Carl, back to semis. As you mentioned, Micron seeing a jump this morning following strong quarterly results last night, beating on the top and bottom lines. CEO Sanjay Mehrotra joined Squawk on the street earlier this morning, touting data center sales, which grew 70% year over year. The chipmaker's fiscal second quarter estimates also beat investor expectations, but it's still trailing the overall semi market, which is up about 40% over the past 12 months, nearly double the NASDAQ. Julia, there's a lot of back and forth around what's hot between the semiconductors, certain software names. The semis hadn't been running. Now they are. A lot of it depends on what demand looks like going out from here. And, you know, we've had this narrative that the demand for semiconductors is just going to be huge into the foreseeable future. We'll see if that remains true.
Well, yeah, it's all about the outlook here. When we see that Micron move higher, I have to think a huge amount of that is because of what the CEO said, saying that they think that supply chain shortages are going to ease in 2022. A lot of optimism there, not across the board, but in certain areas, Carl, and looking at how that easing of those shortages could really be a good tailwind for that company.
Yeah, revenue guide for fiscal Q2, a little bit above the street. Gross margins a little bit ahead. CapEx, John, pretty much in line. But as we've said earlier about this space, you can't just talk about semis as this homogenous beast. There's going to be different varying supply chain dynamics depending on the end market in this case.
There will. And, you know, this is a stock that if we show a full year chart had been higher early in the year. I think there are all kinds of questions about really how the data center plays out. Right now, there's been a lot of demand for cloud services, cloud transformation. We see Marvell has moved quite a bit higher. We just had Matt Murphy on not too long ago talking about the increase in their guidance based on some of that. But if things do cool, and we've learned over the past couple of weeks that, you know, outlooks for various reasons, whether it is a COVID variant or otherwise, can shift. What does that mean, Carl?
Yeah, a bunch of names responding to Micron today. Credit Suisse goes to 130, JPM 115. Wells names it a top pick for 22 with a 115 target. Cowen's Carl Ackerman named it a top pick earlier this month and joins us this morning. Carl, it's great to see you. I wonder what you think was the bigger upside surprise, the supply chain discussion or just the guide period?
Sure. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for having me, and happy holidays. As far as the guidance goes, you know, what's actually happening is there's better demand from automotive and data center markets, as you indicated earlier, and that is resulting in a moderation of memory pricing that is much better than previously expected. And I think that's quite simply the primary reason for the better guide.
Do you think we can take their supply chain discussion and optimism, I guess you could argue, as a lens with which to look at the entire space? Or how much do we need to zero in on that or zoom in on that?
Sure. No, it's a great question. I think, you know, if we take a step back, quite frankly, I think to us, Micron is a value to growth story as memory is increasingly becoming more critical in heterogeneous compute workloads in the data center and increasingly in automotive. So, you know, Micron quite simply is one of just three providers of DRAM. DRAM and NAND are now becoming a larger portion of the overall semis demand. It was 20% of demand 5 years ago. Now it's over 30%. So We think that continues. So Micron should continue to outperform peers. But as we think about the overall market, we are seeing better demand for data center and for automotive areas of the market. We certainly liked Micron going to 2022, but you referenced Marvell earlier. Marvell and MACOM are also our top ideas going into 2022, in part because all three of these companies are really levered to very strong product cycles in data center and in 5G, both from an infrastructure standpoint and a mobile phone standpoint, that we think are very critical areas for all semis going into 2022.
Yeah, Carl, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your broader thoughts on this sector and whether there's anything to be gleaned from that bullish outlook going into next year that we heard from Micron. Do you think that there are any of these companies that are really poorly positioned compared to the rest of the universe? I mean, you just mentioned some of your picks, but what are the ones you're most cautious on?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think all semis should do well next year. We at Cowen believe semis should grow at a high single-digit rate. But we prefer companies that are exposed to the automotive restocking opportunity. In my space, Wolfspeed, I think, is one of them. And in the data center space, we believe you should be exposed more to the optical upgrade cycle to PAM4. That includes Marvell and MACOM. And you should be exposed more to the Android ecosystem in smartphones, and that includes Micron, and Qorvo in the RF space. So that's how we would characterize the relative positioning within semis. We don't think semis are going to do poorly next year. Quite frankly, we think they do all well. But we would highlight those companies that should outperform their broader semi peers.
Carl, what do you expect to see happen with inventories going forward? I wonder, in a state like the one that we're in, if customers have had to promise to take on certain levels of inventory in order to get allocated, and if there's any degree of demand slowdown, could there be an inventory issue in 2022? Do you have insight into how that's played out?
We do. In memory, quite frankly, you are seeing a moderation in inventory in the channel for our PCs, for servers, and even for mobile phones. Mobile phones actually do have the higher amount of inventory across all end markets. However, you are, again, seeing that pared down in data center, and in PC markets, which are critical areas of the market for memory. As you think about the opportunities for next year, we would highlight Marvell and MACOM as key beneficiaries. Why? Well, because they are more exposed to 5G infrastructure. They are more exposed to aerospace and defense. These are longer duration product areas that you are not so reliant on a sell-through from a consumer device. So that's how we would also characterize that opportunity.
Hey, finally, Carl, not to get too macro, but I wonder, we talk a lot about tightening financial conditions, input costs weighing on margins for 2022. When you think about would-be headwinds to enterprise IT investment, I mean, are there things that could clamp that down in the year to come, or is that the last thing these corporates are going to cut back spending on?
To your point, I think it's probably the last thing that corporates cut back spending on. Data is increasingly important in our economy. The analysis of that data, the storage of that data are all very critical. And semis play a key important role in that, in that area of the market. I think 5G infrastructure spending are very durable areas of the market going into 2022.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how corporates do that calculus. Micron definitely helping out today, up 9%, as you can see. Carl, thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Julia?
Turning to the broader market, tech stocks rebounding this morning, recouping almost all of yesterday's losses on the Nasdaq. E-commerce has been one of the sectors hit particularly hard. Our Mike Santoli is looking at that down at the NYSE.
Yeah, Julia, bouncing today, some of the e-commerce stocks, but just like a lot of the very beaten down areas, it seems like a little more of a reflex. Take a look at how this ETF iBuy that tracks online commerce plays, as well as Clicks, which is long online commerce and short physical stores have done. This is over 2 years. I wanted to show the 2 year because this makes it look like e-commerce is in kind of a free fall. But really what it's doing is just giving back a big chunk of the outperformance that we had there. It seems like this is what happens when you have another COVID surge in a world that doesn't seem intent on locking down. Nobody thinks it's going to be this indefinite kind of stay at home type of dynamic, at least for now. And these stocks are getting hurt on a net basis recently, but still retaining some of their upside. I will say the iBuy has a lot of travel related stocks in it. So Expedia, Booking Holdings, Airbnb, all in there. So it's not just pure shopping at home. One final element of this, guys, is it seems like a play that was run too many times. Just rush for the very kind of textbook stay-at-home plays when things go a little bit soft in terms of the macro economy. And that seems like it's just not that much of a tight linkage as it was before.
I wonder how much of what we're looking at is e-commerce, how much of it is direct-to-consumer? Because I look at, say, Stitch Fix, Peloton, Warby, and how they've performed over the past period of time, you know, say a few weeks or months. And I look at Shopify, which is also an e-commerce play, but not in the same sense, a little bit more of a platform play, and it's done better. Any sense that you have of some of those dynamics as you've been looking at these stocks?
Yeah, well, you absolutely hit on it. So if you're kind of a narrowly focused kind of single product set direct to consumer, the market perceives there not being a tremendous amount of room to operate, and that's why those have underperformed a fair degree. The other part of it is that, obviously, omnichannel is a big deal. So these companies that have had all this time, like, you know, Target, Walmart, all the rest of them, to figure things out are now, you know, somewhat more super scale players in this area and make it a little bit tough for the pure plays to navigate.
Mike, explain to me what's going on with all these stocks that are so exposed to the Omicron variant. I mean, I see the movie theater stocks up 4%. You have the gym stocks that are up. You have Live Nation is up 6%. What's going on here? I mean, I understand that there was a pullback, but this seems like a pretty dramatic move.
It's dramatic in the short term, Julie. Absolutely. There's this sort of clenching up and unclenching effect that's gone on in the markets right now. Every time we have one of these scares, and this one started right the day after Thanksgiving, so you had a few weeks where people were on guard about it, and the market, in its kind of bloodless way, says, well, that's nothing but a reopening trade in the making. And so let's get positioned for when eventually that's going to be the move. So from certain levels, I do see a little bit of perking up of certainly pure play travel. Also, the travel numbers have not really suffered lately, at least not yet. And so people are, you know, resorting to a little bit of that. Very noisy environment, though, here in year end when you have so many stocks that got swamped in the last several years. And you don't really know if they're just bouncing or if people are perceiving, you know, new life to those themes going into next year.
Yeah, I think, I mean, your point about not drawing broad conclusions from this late year trading, Mike, is such a good one. But I do wonder if you think it kind of explains what you've been talking about, explains, say, for example, the twos, tens today, this idea that maybe we're going to sort of power through this in some fashion.
Right. Very low appetite for broad restrictions or curtailments of activity so far. I do think that's part of it. You know, we're also starting from such a high base of growth in terms of the fourth quarter numbers. Yeah, they've gone downscale, but there's still, you know, nominal growth above 10%. I keep pointing to nominal growth. That's kind of key for earnings and overall revenue pies. And so, therefore, you can whittle it down a little bit and still not be in this precarious position where the economy's at stall speed.
All right. Mike Santoli, thank you.
Yeah.
After the break, exclusive insights from Bob Iger's exit interview. We will get his thoughts on the streaming landscape, hear some of his biggest regrets, including not thinking of YouTube himself. Tech Check, just getting started.
Let's get a gut check on Alibaba. Shares up more than 3% this morning, despite Atlantic Equities cutting to neutral, cutting the price target as well. They were at 185. They go down to 140. Worried about Tmall shopping, saying little confidence that the performance will improve in the near term, although they do say, guys, that the stock is still inexpensive at this point.
And shifting gears, Bob Iger steps down as Disney chairman at the end of the year. Our David Faber sitting down with Iger to talk about his tenure. David, you know, here on Tech Talk, we've been so focused on streaming, and I know that's something that you talked about with him as well.
Yeah, of course, Julie, and something you've been very focused on as well as your coverage of the company. Direct-to-consumer certainly being such an important component overall of their strategy. I know we can both remember back in, what was it, August of 2015 on that earnings conference call when, for the first time, Iger addressed potential sub-erosion at the giant cash-flowing property ESPN. Since then, of course, it's no secret that the linear ecosystem has been in decline, and certainly Iger acknowledges that as well.
I think you're seeing a migration to more digital, direct-to-consumer forms of entertainment distribution. And being in that business at a larger scale, which, because I think that will provide more growth for the company than the traditional media platforms would have. And just the migration, the erosion of the traditional media platforms and the growth of the new ones, we're playing in that new space much more aggressively than we would have, obviously without Disney Plus, but without Hulu as well. I think people are consuming things in much more different ways. App-based entertainment in the home is replacing the linear channel consumption in the home. So when you go back to the question you asked about the future of that business, it's not bright at all. It's actually eroding right before our eyes.
And it continues to erode before our eyes. You know, it was a long interview and opportunity to talk to Iger about so many different things, best decisions in which he sort of talked about the decision to buy Pixar, and worst decisions as well, where YouTube came up.
I remember when YouTube was sold. One of the things I always rued because when YouTube emerged is that we didn't see that first. I'm the one who put America's Funniest Videos on ABC right. In 1989, which was user-generated content. It's kind of funny, which YouTube really started as.
Yes.
It's evolved tremendously. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah, why? Yeah.
I don't know.
I missed that one. It's worth about $300 billion now, by the way, based on its revenue.
Buying YouTube would have been smart.
It would have been. All right, so that gets me to worst decision. Is there one that comes to mind in terms of just a really bad decision you made over those 16-plus years?
I made some bad decisions. Fortunately, they weren't monumental. They would have brought me down. So I can't really think of, like, the worst decision. I made some bonehead creative decisions along the way. You know, greenlit some things I probably shouldn't have.
All right,
I
mean, but saying yes to easy. Cop Rock is not exactly the worst decision you're going to make.
You know, that's actually, it's interesting. I try to be honest and candid, both in terms of assessment of myself. I definitely made a bunch of bad decisions, sometimes people, sometimes product. Nothing gigantic.
Nothing gigantic?
No.
And nothing comes to mind at all that you can share?
A bunch of little things.
Just little things.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a pretty good tenure then, if it's a bunch of
little things. Well, I lasted a long time, so I guess it suggests I didn't make any really bad any big bad decisions.
Julia, of course, his tenure is coming to an end, which is the reason we sat down for that long interview. You've covered the company closely as well. And as you well know, and we started with, direct-to-consumer is key of mind for so many, although we don't want to forget about things like the parks, where we were at Disneyland, of course, in front of that Star Wars attraction as well. Still a very important component overall for this company.
Yeah, the parks are certainly important, but if you think about the part of the business that Iger has really transformed, it really comes down to that moment where back in August of that year, he said ESPN is having trouble and we're going to work to address that. And if you think, David, about how much he transformed the company, you know, with the growth of Disney Plus, ESPN Plus, this bundle of Hulu, ESPN Plus, and Disney Plus, I wonder if there's a sense that he really wanted to get that extra Fox content to bolster that library. I know there's still questions about that Fox deal, sort of bigger picture, but is that what it's really about? Building a company that can be direct consumer to consumer with enough content on its own?
Yeah, without a doubt. And as you point out, the Fox deal was crucial in sort of bulking up and really making much more robust the offering for direct to consumer. You know, Iger will come back to the Simpsons often. I think at some point during the course of the rest of the day, perhaps we will share a bit more on his thoughts about Fox, because as you point out, you know, there had been some criticism about the price paid. His point would be, well, we sold the RSNs pretty quickly at actually what turned out to be a decent price, the regional sports networks, because of the decline in that business. And he also points out, of course, the Sky sale, which our parent company helped to buy at a very high price. So he says the adjusted price, not as big as you would think. But, yeah, those Fox assets are key, and obviously that continues to be a question for Mr. Chapek in terms of both the integration and the ability to make even more robust the direct-to-consumer offering at Disney. Shares of which are having a very strong day, by the way.
David, put on your kind of historian hat for a moment, if you will, along with your strategy hat that you've always got on. When I think Iger and legacy, I think Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm getting, you know, each of those for under $10 billion, which in retrospect seems just like a yard sale. And so it was interesting to me that he pointed out YouTube, because my recollection of the rise of YouTube, sure, it was user-generated content, but they were stealing a lot of premium content in order to get popular in the beginning, including SNL. I mean, I'm not sure YouTube would be YouTube if Disney had bought it.
No, you know, you're right. And we can always go through those kinds of exercises, John, with so many different companies. What if? What if? And yet the question is, well, what would have become of if it, in fact, had gone that route? And I think that's a very good point. There are certainly plenty of conflicts if Disney had actually, for example, stepped up to buy YouTube at that point. I guess Iger's point was, listen, it should have at least occurred to us, given our history of having success with user-generated content, that this could become something of great significance. You know, there are plenty of misses out there for these companies, but your point is a very good one. That series of acquisitions, beginning with Pixar and then moving on as well to Marvel and Lucasfilm, and we were sitting there, of course, in front of the Millennium Falcon, that was key to sort of bulking up this company. And those franchises, it does appear again, you know, at the time, actually, those of us in the financial media may have criticized some of the price. I certainly remember having done so with Jobs and Iger when they came on this very air. In fact, I think I was sitting it right here saying, man, you're paying, I forget what the multiple was, John, but it was a high multiple, not really understanding perhaps all the different things that they were getting and what they were doing in terms of rejuvenating the animation part of Disney, which Iger points out really continues to be much of the key engine for creativity at the company.
Yeah, we forget how challenged actually Disney Animation had been in some ways prior to the Pixar deal. Finally, David, you know I hesitate to bring it up, but our Alex Sherman did solicit some anonymous media executives' predictions for 22, and one of them was that Iger would return as Disney CEO in the coming year. Certainly there's zero indication of that in your conversation.
Yeah, I think if there's anything, he makes it extraordinarily clear that he is leaving and he is not coming back. I would be, frankly, shocked if that prediction were to come true.
Well, just remarkable, remembering all the times that he did delay his departure. And also just looking at his transformation of that company over the years, the shift to direct-to-consumer, and also all those massive acquisitions. Such a fascinating interview. Thank you so much, David. And meanwhile, coming up, we are going into the metaverse. Take a look.
It's Julia Boorstin. Here I am as an avatar inside Meta's Horizon Workrooms apps. Welcome to the metaverse. I'll take you around, show you what you can expect. That's coming up later in Tech Check.
Welcome back to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with John Fort and Julia Boorstin. Got the Dow awfully close to session highs once again. Chips and Chinese names are helping to lead the NDX a little higher this morning. We'll get more on a couple of those names in just a moment. First, though, a news update with our Frank Holland. Hey, Frank.
Hey there, Carl. Here's what's happening at this hour. General Mills is one of the biggest laggards in the S&P 500 today. Revenues topped estimates, but profits, they were light on rising cost. This despite price increases on many General Mills products. The company expects more hikes over the next 6 months. Workers at a Kellogg cereal plant have approved a new labor contract. The deal paves the way for the end of a 2.5-month-long strike. The union says its members can be back at work next Monday. And Boeing helping lead the Dow higher. This after UPS placed an order for 19 of Boeing's 767 freight planes. Despite today's 5% rise, Boeing shares are still near their 52-week low. They remain down 7% on the year. And the big consumer electronics show in Las Vegas, the show will go on. Organizers confirming that CES will open 2 weeks from tomorrow. Participants must show proof of vaccination and wear face coverings indoors. They're also being encouraged to test for COVID before heading to Las Vegas. That's the very latest. Carl, back over to you.
All right, Frank, thanks very much. We mentioned a bunch of movers in action today, especially surrounding the semis. Let's get to Josh Lipton for more on that. Hey, Josh.
So, Carl, let's get to those movers. We'll start with Micron, of course, ripping higher in today's trade on that strong earnings report. Remember, coming off a strong November as well when it surged about 20%. More broadly, take a step back, look at the SMH, the ETF that tracks the chips, also in the green, names like Broadcom, Marvell. Those are the best performers so far in December, though that ETF still in the red for the month, its first negative month in three. Also worth highlighting, Citrix jumping on a report that Elliott Investment Management and Vista Equity Partners considering a joint bid for the software maker. That stock enjoying its first positive month now in three, best month since March 2020. SolarEdge Technologies. Now, yesterday, remember, its worst day since May 4th, but today, different story. Moving higher, solar equipment maker named a top pick at Cowen, which says investor enthusiasm remains high for both solar and fuel cell technology. Julia, back to you.
Thanks, Josh. And let's stay with this theme. Stocks bouncing after yesterday's sharp sell-off. Joining us now, the Wall Street Journal's Gunjan Banerjee, also a CNBC contributor. Gunjan, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us what you're seeing now that the everything rally is over. What's the divergence you're seeing within the tech space?
That's right. I really think the everything rally, as you just said, is over. People have dumped some of the more speculative growth focused names, whether that's, you know, the ARK Innovation Fund, Plug Power. They have fled those names. And at the same time, we've obviously seen stocks like Apple outperform. And I think it goes back to, you know, some of those growth focused, unprofitable names have taken a beating lately. As the journal reported today, you know, more than 300 unprofitable growth names are down more than 50% from their highs. That's compared to the NASDAQ, the broader NASDAQ being down around 7 or 8% from its highs. So there's really a big divergence between the more speculative corners of the growth space and some of the other winners.
And what about this coming Fed rate hike cycle? What can we see or take from history to help us understand what's going to happen next year?
So one of the themes that keeps coming up in my conversations with investors is, are we going to go back to or stay in this low yield environment, go back to more sluggish growth? And that was, you know, the perfect storm for tech to flourish. Tech did really well over the past decade. And now I'm hearing investors ask, is that environment going to come to an end? Obviously, inflation is one of the biggest wild cards there. They're asking, how much are yields going to rise? And, you know, one thing I was thinking about is going back to 2015, when the Fed was first lifting off for the first time since the financial crisis. I was surprised to see that Amazon and Netflix were two of the best performers in the S&P 500 this year. So I think it goes to show you that the sector is pretty tough to bet against, even though a lot of people are calling for kind of this rotation into more cyclical corners of the market right now.
Gunjan, I wonder how you're thinking about the remarkably wide dispersion in 22 year-end S&P targets right now. The strategists are all over the map. But even those who think we're going to get some kind of multiple compression next year, they do admit that at least S&P earnings are looking to be pretty good at this point, whether that's a result of growth or buybacks or what have you.
So one thing I keep hearing is that it seems like earnings will grow more and more important. And we're seeing that with, you know, the Micron move today, these huge moves we're seeing in tech and software companies after their earnings, some of the biggest moves after earnings of the past decade. But I think in terms of the dispersion, that speaks to like just the number of challenges we have ahead of us. Right now, it's the variant. Obviously, inflation has been at the forefront, supply chain issues around the globe. You know, it just seems like wild card after wild card keeps coming our way, and that's reflected in that dispersion that you're talking about.
Gunjan, a piece I enjoyed in the journal this morning was about five big stocks that have been holding up the S&P, right? Microsoft, NVIDIA, Apple, Alphabet, and Tesla. Now, there tends to be this thought, well, out of this and into that. But, I mean, what if none of these things is really safe? How much risk do you see in those five stocks if they get re-rated?
You know, that's a good question. I think it goes back to, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, where I feel like for so long, people have been calling for this rotation away from those stocks. And it just hasn't happened yet. It's almost like the boy who cried wolf at this point. And you know, I've been speaking to a lot of retail investors this year. Many of them have piloted into the market over the past year. And, you know, they kind of consider those stocks the safety plays. They're piling into the Teslas, the Apples, the Amazons of the world. And they really view them as pretty bulletproof. So, you know, if that changes, that's definitely a big risk to the market. And of course, some of those stocks have seen some weakness lately, and that's weighed on the broader market in recent weeks.
Gunjan, thank you very much. Great to have you and talk about where we are in terms of earnings and the markets for the coming year. But John, as we said earlier, strategists really having to wrestle with a bunch of unknowns, not just in the near term, but for the coming quarters, whether that's inflation, global growth, Omicron, supply chain. She really summed that up pretty well.
Yeah, there are always unknowns, but the last couple of years certainly have had an extra helping for sure. And now after the break, how to invest in the metaverse. We're going to take a look at some of the public companies making the biggest bets on a new reality. We're back in a moment.
It's day one of our three-part series on the metaverse, what investors need to know about this phenomenon. And we may be years away from a truly connected immersive world, but mini metaverses or parts of the metaverse, the tech platform that could define the future, are already here. Mark Zuckerberg's vision of the metaverse is fully immersive with VR headsets, but people are already exploring virtual worlds without hardware. Let's build an avatar. Decentraland, which is run on Ethereum, allows anyone to build an avatar. Okay, I've got some earrings. You can explore, talk to other avatars, play blackjack in a virtual casino, and even buy digital real estate. Oh, this is where you would buy land. Companies can also buy ad space on digital billboards. Roblox isn't just a kid's game. It was an early pioneer of virtual worlds where avatars can play games or attend virtual concerts. And now you can buy digital products from big name fashion brands like Ralph Lauren to outfit your avatar. Look, I can buy a Ralph Lauren beanie for my avatar. Users can buy and then use Robux, that's the digital currency inside Roblox, to acquire these virtual goods.
If you want the real virtual immersive experience, you need to have a headset. I'm wearing the Quest 2. This is the avatar I built to explore Horizon Worlds, which is the new app that Meta just launched out of beta.
Meta is also working to bring remote workers into a similar virtual space. This app is called Facebook Workrooms, and it's designed for meetings. It's a sign of what a professional piece of the metaverse will look like. Another promising use case for VR headsets, fitness. One of the companies leading the way is FitXR. It offers dancing, boxing, and high-intensity interval training classes, all in a virtual space. It was a lot of fun to build those avatars and explore those virtual worlds, both in 2D and in VR. But for some of them, it did take a while to load the websites and set the various avatars up. I have to say this headset is a lot better than some of the previous generations. Still isn't quite as easy as setting up an iPhone. I also want to show this other thing. This is the hand control. This is how I was moving my hands around, and it was capturing that. I could also put it down and it would capture my hand movement up here. So a lot going on there. But tomorrow we will be diving into more of some of the milestones that are going to come up for the metaverse to make it more accessible. But it's certainly off to a start, John.
Yeah, and just so the people can see, here's the box that stuff comes in that you were just holding up there. I got one here of my own. See, even though I'm a skeptic of certain parts of the metaverse, I'm not down on the entire experience. But I wonder, Julia, was there anything in the metaverse that was better than doing it in real life? Or is it just sort of like a fallback kind of opportunity?
So, John, we're going to have to go into Facebook workrooms. I'm sorry, Horizon workrooms owned by Meta, formerly known as Facebook. And we're going to have to put on our headsets and try to have a meeting in there, because you and I normally will brainstorm. We'll do it on the phone or we'll do it on Microsoft Teams. But I'm curious to see if it feels more like we're in the room and having a real brainstorming session. I was really impressed by the whiteboard and the fact that I could stand up and I felt like I was writing on this monitor that's here behind me by just sort of pressing with my hand control. That was impressive. But I thought one thing was that in this virtual world, I did feel like I had actually met these people in person more than just talking to them on a Zoom, these people who work at Meta. So I think it's still early days. And I'm still, you know, trying to figure out how to make the most of these virtual worlds. But the fascinating thing is that this technology is only going to get more sophisticated, Carl. So obviously, you know, I'd rather see you in person or a hologram of you, which we'll talk about later, rather than have a cartoon character version of you. But the question is, what does this look like in 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I think we now have a challenge to be the first show to do a segment entirely in the metaverse. John, I think we can make that happen. I did notice two things. One is that the revenue chain from, say, Ralph Lauren is not beholden to supply constraints. That's one thing which is interesting. And I also heard yesterday Reid Hoffman tell you about how important, say, live music is going to be to this new technology.
Yeah, we've already been seeing a lot of entertainment happen in the metaverse. I mean, look at Fortnite. Fortnite has these concerts. So you say, well, Fortnite's a video game. It's like, yes, it's a video game, but people build avatars and they go and experience this virtual world of Fortnite. So I would say that the video game companies are the ones that are most ahead of the curve here in terms of bringing people into virtual worlds, giving them different experiences. Roblox and Fortnite have both done a lot of concerts. And I think that when you look at people being stuck at home during the pandemic, maybe that's a little bit more appealing than when you can get out and about and actually go buy tickets to a real concert. But I do think we'll increasingly see entertainment, Carl, in the metaverse. People are doing a lot more fitness stuff in the metaverse. And we mentioned Ralph Lauren. Nike has been talking a lot about selling virtual goods. These are branding companies. These are companies that really want to make sure that their brand is out there on every platform and people are willing to spend money.
Wow, it's such a good insight, especially given sort of your historical intelligence on the evolution of the tech, Julia, and we can't wait to hear a lot more. One more buzzword that we should mention this morning is similar but unrelated, and that's Web3. Jack Dorsey setting off a bit of a firestorm, tweeting, "You don't own Web3. The VCs and their LPs do. It'll never escape their incentives. It's ultimately a centralized entity with a different label. Know what you're getting into." Elon Musk replies, "Has anyone seen Web3? I can't find it." And then crypto evangelist and Andreessen partner Chris Dixon argues, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you. We are here." To which Dorsey replied, "You're a fund determined to be a media empire that can't be ignored, not Gandhi." John, fascinating series of conversations all over the place this week about sort of technology that is meant to be decentralized, but as the journal pointed out, with crypto at least, a lot of it is owned by a few big players.
I mean, it's sad to see the billionaires have turned on the multimillionaires. I mean, where will it stop? Very strange, Julia. I thought that Dorsey and Musk are sort of against this Web3 idea, not against the Web3 idea, but I guess against the idea that it's decentralized when really it's being pushed by investors who have a history of wanting to make a profit down the line, arguing, I guess, that they're going to shape this, and in their shaping of it, they're going to keep it from being the sort of helpful anarchy that it otherwise would have been. You think that is going to be a theme going forward from here about Web3 and how different perhaps it is from Web 2.0?
100%. But let's just take a step back here. So what is Web3? First, what is Web 1? Web 1 was the first generation of the Internet, and that was really defined by search and Google. Then Web 2 has been defined as being really about social and mobile. That's what Web 2 is about. It's all about the apps that you can have on your phone. Now, what is Web3? People say that Web3 is really about a decentralized Internet that is built on the blockchain. So built by, of, and for the people. And I would actually say that the metaverse is adjacent to or is part of Web3, because for a metaverse to really be real, it has to be, you know, interoperable, and it has to be all be built on the blockchain. So I think those things are very closely connected. But the concern that I'm actually hearing from some of my sources right now is that what we're seeing that these VCs are really investing in and pushing is sort of an NFT world where they're trying to raise the prices of what these things are selling for, these virtual goods, and they're trying to make a market that they then profit from. So they are, you know, Carl, trying to take this thing that was supposed to be open and of the people.
I also got to throw in real quick, there's a difference between Web 3.0 and Web 3. So be careful out there, people. Be sure you know what the person at the other side of the table is talking about.
Meantime, as we go to break, another big call on telecom this morning. UBS says they're expecting a strong end to the year. Despite a slowdown in sub growth, that financials should remain intact. They maintain a buy on AT&T. Price target 34. We're back in a moment.
After the break, shares of cloud marketing platform Braze popping after reporting results. You see them up there, 14.5%. CEO joins us next. Welcome back. We focused so much on problems with high growth software in the last few weeks. Here's a counterexample. Shares of the cloud marketing firm Braze popping this morning after reporting results for the first time since its November IPO. Revenue beat up 63% year over year. Joining us now, Braze CEO Bill Magnuson. Bill, welcome. So clearly we can see a lot is going right here. I want to point out the market cap is over $6 billion. Revenue in the quarter, just over $64 million. So quite a valuation here. Tell me about how you're structuring yourselves for growth and to what degree you're being cautious based on what the demand environment might be in 22.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you look at Braze's addressable market, we're still very much in the early innings, and we're also benefiting from a lot of secular tailwinds and trends that have been kind of pushing momentum in our direction and compounding with each other. So when you look across the board, you know, the move to first-party data, which I'm sure that you guys have spoken a lot about in the last few months as we saw the changes from IDFA recently. Obviously, the digitization that's happening through COVID. We also, more narrowly in the customer engagement space, have seen changes in the craft of customer engagement, that it has become a more interdisciplinary activity. All of these things are really benefiting Braze and kind of leading to additional tailwinds. And you combine that with just how early we are in this market. You know, we're still investing very heavily, and we see a ton of opportunity ahead of us.
I wonder, in your investment for growth, which of course is important, to what degree do you structurally hedge for potential downside, you know, operationally, either in how you hire or in how you structure the infrastructure that you need for growth? Because if demand does slack off at some point, even temporarily, on the way to that total addressable market figure you mentioned, how are you prepared to handle it?
Yeah, so I think a lot of that comes down to the diversity across the dimensions of geography and across verticals, as well as across the different use cases that we service. If we go back to the early days of 2020, you know, in those first couple quarters, what we saw was obviously slowdowns in a lot of in-person commerce and a lot of other kind of events and travel and such. But in our own customer base, we then also saw massive acceleration in businesses that would be providing things like digital services, on-demand delivery, et cetera. And so when we kind of look across all of the diversity of geographies and verticals that we have an ability to quickly pivot and change our own focus. You know, definitely when you look at the revenue growth of the last couple of years, the total amount of revenue growth was not a surprise, but I would say that the composition was, because we saw a lot of growth in financial services. We saw a lot of growth in health and wellness. We obviously saw other categories like travel and hospitality went down, but Braze is able to actually operate across all these different verticals. So as long as we've got our finger on the pulse of what's going on from a consumer standpoint, and we've got good visibility into our pipeline, then we can put investments into the right place and really check those downside risks.
All right. Bill, the stock there now up 15.5%. The CEO of Braze, thank you.
Thank you.
Meantime, you missed part of the show. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to our podcast. S&P's up better than 1%. Tech Chuck's back in a moment.
Talk about that?
S&P awfully close to session highs here, 46.15. We were at 46.20 a moment ago, John. Hard to say what drives the intraday trading at this point, but there was a Bloomberg report earlier this morning that the antivirals over at Pfizer and Merck could be seeing some regulatory clearance as soon as this week. And that did, I think, tend to coincide with the leg up that we got this morning.
Yeah, we're slowly getting a sense of the reaction to this Omicron strain, which we got the report yesterday, is now 73% new cases. Julia, the Consumer Electronics Show is going on with testing and other protocols.
Yeah, and yes, we see Disney shares up 3%. Obviously, they have that exposure.
Yeah, definitely helping things out.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.